Hey there, welcome to Board Game Hot Takes, the podcast where we give our immediate reactions to the hottest board games just minutes after playing them. My name's Tim.
And this is Chris.
And today we're going to give our hot take on the game we just finished playing, The Isle of Cats. But before we talk about that game, a couple things. One is you might notice that it's only two of us today, which we don't do very often. And if you're a regular listener of the show, you know that Jen has been begging to play Isle of Cats and talk about it and review it with us. So we did intend to have Jen on tonight, but she unfortunately had to cancel at the last minute. So you don't get to hear Jen's voice tonight, and you're stuck with me and Chris. But, you know, the show must go on. So here we go. I do have a poll question and some results to discuss before we jump into the description of Isle of Cats. So today on Twitter, I asked, what does your ideal game night look like regarding number and length of games? And the options I gave were one epically long game, a couple mid-length games, many short games, or one long and some short games, which could also be like, you know, a medium length and some short games. But basically, do you have an anchor with a few fillers around it? So those were my four options. And Chris, you said you didn't see the poll before we started tonight. So what's your answer? What would be your choice for a game night?
I didn't see it, so I'm doing this completely on the fly, so you're getting my real immediate reaction to this. And the answer is one short game and one epic game. Is that one of the options?
No, it was not one of the options.
No. Okay, well, hey, even better. So the fifth option.
If it's an epic game, that's all you got. You don't get anything else, but you could have a long-ish game and some short games. So one long game and some short games.
Yeah, well, we get into these definitional issues, so it really depends on what you call epic. So
somebody asked that question, and they said, what do you consider a mid-length game? And so I said a mid-length, to me, is like 1 to 2 hours. That's a nice mid-length game.
Yeah.
And then anything that's much longer than 2 hours, I would call a long game.
Yeah.
But an epically long game, something that the only thing you're going to play in one night, that's like a 3.5 to 4 hour game. If I've even got a 3 hour game, we could still drop in a filler game.
Well, we manage to generally turn even a game of Welcome To into a 3 or 4 hour game. So but that's a talent that we have. I'm not sure I play a lot of epic games. I think probably one of the biggest, heaviest, longest games that I play is Terraforming Mars is a good example. You know, that about that way, pretty complex, but I don't know if you call that epic or not. But I'll use that as my sort of baseline. A nice light game, something like Welcome To is a good example. A Hand of Shamans, followed by a nice meaty game like Terraforming Mars or Cthulhu Wars or, you know, any of those, I think is a sweet spot for me. That's a fun game night. What did you say?
I think that's a great fit. Now, I said a couple mid-length games. Like, if I've got a perfect game night, it's like two games that are 1 to 2 hours. So we have a little variety. We have a little bit of a multiple kind of, you know, climaxes and the whole arc of the game's happening. And I'd rather spend the time with two of those rather than one longer one and one short filler game. Although I like that too. That's a fun game night. If we're playing a long game, I'm hoping to get a little filler in before or after. I'm always looking forward to that. So that's cool too. So here's how people answered the poll. Only 8% said one epically long game. And I think of an epically long game, something like Star Wars Rebellion. You know, you got a couple people together to just play like a full night game, or even a game like maybe Eclipse, Second Dawn is usually going to be like a 3 hour game. You might fit a filler in with that too, but that's going to take up most of your night. 53% agreed with me and said a couple mid-length games. 4% said many short games. So at least the people that are responding on Twitter, that follow us on Twitter, they're not fans of just a whole bunch of short games. I thought I was kind of expecting a little higher than that, I guess. I don't know. I don't know why I expected that, because I wouldn't want that. But I get the sense that people tend to like little lighter party-ish games more. But obviously the poll results are not showing that. And then 35% agreed with you and said one long and some short. So, you know, fair enough. A long game has some value to it. You really get to dig in and have that full experience. So that's cool. But then get some little short games to go along with it.
You know, I'm starting to come to your side of this one too, Tim. I mean, when I think about the games that we've been playing a lot recently and that are really enjoyable, especially if you have a pretty liberal interpretation of what's a medium weight game, you know, even something like Blood Rage is, I'd say, somewhere between medium and heavy. But certainly something like that, along with another game of a similar weight, that can be a great game night. If there's not like a palate cleanser or an appetizer and then a main course, there's two decent sized chunks of game in there. And I think that's a lot of fun too.
Yeah, 100%. When we live close to each other, we used to get together in person, and I was holding the weekly game night. And I remember most of the time what we would do is we'd have one game, what kind of one bigger game that we'd play. And then I'd usually start with an intro while we were waiting for someone to get there. Or I'd ask if anyone wanted to play a little light game at the end. But my favorite game nights were when we would finish a game and have enough time where it's like, oh, everyone's still awake enough. Let's bust out. Let's play it again. Or let's bust out another game that's a similar weight. I remember one time I actually prepped for it. I set up two midweight games on my dining room table because it was like an 8-person dining room table. It was long enough. So I set up two games. And that was the one night when everybody canceled last minute. So like I had four people committed and everybody last minute. Sorry, Tim, I can't make it tonight. Sorry, Tim, I got a family commitment. And so it was so pathetic. Like I'm sitting at home with these two games fully set up, two Euro games set up on my table. Oh, man, so sad. But yeah, that's my ideal. So we had a few.
That's a bummer.
Yeah, we had a few comments here. This random guy, BGHT Adam, said, my ideal is a board game weekend with all of these bonus points if I'm tired and grumpy on day three. I have a deja vu just listening to that answer.
Yes, he sounds like a complete lunatic.
Cardboard Time said, I think a couple of mid-length games strikes a nice balance between variety and learning different rule sets. Yeah, 100%. That's how I 100% agree. Like, you get a little variety in there. It's not too heavy. You're not trying to, like, spend an hour teaching the game. Pretty easy to get into those mid-weight games. So Cardboard Time is right on here. Riley Stock said, my ideal game night looks like a group of friends having fun playing games. But if it has to fit those parameters, I think one game that's 1 to 2 hours long and maybe a few that are under an hour. And I responded and said, it does have to fit one of those parameters. I don't make the rules, and I wish people would stop pushing the edge cases here all the time.
To Riley's point there, I'm not sure I can agree because, yeah, I want to say if people are having fun and we're playing decent games, then I'm happy. But that's not true. I mean, I want to play the games I want to play, and they usually end up being at least one medium to heavyweight game. And if you don't have that in there, I mean, it's not like you can't have fun, but it is not what I would call an optimal game night.
Exactly. We got to stop conflating having fun with being the best that you can be. All right. Well, let's jump into a description of the Isle of Cats.
What a catastrophe. The evil Lord Vesh has set sail for your island home, where his goal is to, believe it or not, wipe out cats. Because why not, right? But you won't let him get away with it. In Isle of Cats, a 1-4 player game, you'll travel the island, seek out the mythical cats, lure them to your ship, and whisk them away to safety. The game plays out over 5 rounds, or days, each of which is divided into 5 phases. The first phase is the fishing phase, in which you'll get the 20 fish per round that will act as your currency to buy cards and lure cats. In the second phase, players will explore the island. In gameplay terms, this means the players will draft cards that they'll use throughout the rest of the day. The cards fall into a few different categories, though. Lessons are public or private goals that will allow players to maximize their points by meeting various conditions. Rescue cards provide boots that determine player order, and baskets that players will use to capture those sneaky cats. Anytime cards can be used to take valuable one-time actions, and rare find cards allow players to take treasures to fill their ships. At the end of the draft, players will get to purchase as many cards as they want from their drafted hand by paying the card's cost in fish. The third phase is where players read their lessons. In other words, put into play public lessons that provide points to any players who meet a goal, or private lessons that are available only to the card's owner. The fourth phase is the most important and exciting. That's the rescue phase. The rescue cards may have boots or baskets or both, and the number of each will impact the round significantly. First, the group will count up the total boots on each player's cards. The higher the boot count, the earlier the player will be in the player order. And baskets allow players to catch cats. One basket, one cat. So if you play 2 baskets, for example, you can capture a maximum of 2 cats. The trick is that you also need fish to lure the cats, so hopefully you saved a few fish when you were buying your cards. Then comes the fun part. Each cat that you catch comes in the form of a colorful polyomino that, once secured, you can place on your boat. Players will get bonuses for groups of adjoining cats in the same family or color, and by covering treasure maps. Players can also avoid losing points by catching rats and filling up rooms on their boats. In the fifth phase, the final phase, players will have the opportunity to play rare find cards that reward them with special treasures that can fill up those pesky open spaces left on the boat. After 5 days, the game will end, Points will be tallied, and the player with the most points will win. Isle of Cats was designed by Frank West and is published by the City of Games.
All right, so let's jump in and talk about the gameplay and mechanisms of the Isle of Cats. And Chris, this was your first play. I have the physical production of this game. I've played it probably a dozen times. Tonight we played on Board Game Arena. That was my first play on Board Game Arena, and it was your first play overall. So why don't you start and tell me a little bit about what got you excited about the mechanisms here? What stood out to you?
Well, one thing I'm going to do when we're talking about this is do a lot of comparisons to A Feast for Odin, because I have not played a lot of polyomino games like Isle of Cats or Feast for Odin or Patchwork. We've talked about a little bit tonight. I haven't played a lot of those, so that's the one that is probably closest to my understanding.
Chris, would you consider Tapestry a polyomino game? It also has some of the similar mechanisms in the capital city.
Yeah, maybe so, but it's a minor piece. And that's kind of what I was going to say here, was that Tapestry is a good example. It's in there, and I certainly agree that that is an aspect of the game, and it's an important aspect of the game, but it's a bit of a sideshow. It's one little aspect amongst many, and certainly I don't think anybody would say that is the number one point of the game. In Feast for Odin, it's definitely much more of the game. It's pretty significant, but there's so much stuff going on over on that sideboard where you're choosing the actions that you're taking and the worker placement, that it's really sort of two games, half of the game being worker placement and the other half being the polyominoes and filling in your board. This game, the filling in your board, the polyominoes, that's front and center. And honestly, I found that a lot of fun, where you're really doing some very basic, simple decision-making in order to pick up your cats, which are your polyominoes, those in your treasures, and then focusing most of your attention on where you want those to go. And I thought that was a lot of fun. So I'm curious, because I think you've probably played a lot more of those types of games than I have. What's the more sort of standard version of the polyomino game?
Yeah, I've only played a handful. I played Patchwork and, yeah, A Feast for Odin a lot. And, you know, we talked about Tapestry a little bit. So, yeah, that pretty much covers my polyomino experience. Oh, I played Baron Park, which I didn't like at all. But that's also got some polyomino stuff going on with it. So, yeah, I wouldn't say that I have a huge breadth of experience in that space either. But I agree with you that Isle of Cats, that is the primary game here. Although, interestingly, you know, you compared this to A Feast for Odin, and that's the thing that it made you think of the most. For me, ever since I first played this game, and every time I play it, I actually think more of Terraforming Mars, because I think what feels the closest to any other game to me is the way that you're drafting the cards and then having to pay the cost on the cards and decide, you know, before you get a chance to play them. So it's an interesting choice of, like, I'm drafting these cards, but then I get done with the draft. Do I want to spend my fish, in this case, for these cards before I ever have a chance to kind of execute my plan? And I kind of have to do that up front, but the fish have other values. So if I spend them all now, I'm going to be able to do less with them later. So that reminds me a lot of the Terraforming Mars draft. And then, you know, I have to pay 2 or 3 coins or whatever it is. I think it's 3 credits for these cards. And then I have to then pay to build them later on. So that always felt, I think, the closest link to any other game for me.
That's funny you say that, because I never in a million years would have drawn that comparison, but now that you've said it, I can't unsee it. I mean, it is clearly, there's an element of it that's got some, you know, shared DNA with Terraforming Mars, and it's also good DNA. I mean, I love a draft. I love drafting cards the way you do in Terraforming Mars or Isle of Cats or Blood Rage, any of those drafting games. And that certainly was a lot of fun here as well.
Yeah. Now, one of the things I really like about this particular draft, which is different than Terraforming Mars and the economy of it, is that every round, the game's played over 5 rounds, and every round you just get 20 fish. Fish are the coins, basically. They're the currency in this game. You don't have to work for it. There are cards that will get you more fish. You can get some of the instant action cards through the game that will give you fish based on something. Like, you could get 2 fish per large treasure you've got, or you could get 2 fish per Oshak's cat or something like that. That's kind of interesting. I mean, I like that. And it reminds me a little bit of La Granja, where at the beginning of the round, you just play a card. One of my favorite parts of some of these games is where you don't have to work for every little thing you do. Sometimes you just get stuff and then you get to spend it. And then it doesn't feel like just punishment all the time. It's like, I just get something and I get to do something with it. And that makes me happy. It's fun for me. So I appreciate that here versus like Terraforming Mars, where, you know, you start with almost no money production and then you have to kind of work your way up. You've got to build it up to actually get anything. Here, you can pretty much do most of what you want to do. There's a little bit of pressure on the economy. You know, 20 fish isn't quite enough to draft to buy every card that you drafted, as well as buy all the cats you want. So sometimes you have to give up some cards, or you may not be able to pick up all the cats you wanted to. So I like that, but at least it feels like you've got a good turn. You've got a good start to what you can do on that round. So I appreciate that with this draft.
You know, you pointed out the freedom of movement in this game, so to speak. And honestly, that's one of my favorite things about it, because so many games that we play, the amount of restriction on you is absolutely stifling. And in a lot of ways, that's important, because if you didn't have restriction, then there wouldn't be a game. It would just be a free-for-all. But in this game, there seems to be a really nice balance of restriction with the freedom to do whatever you'd like to do. Like, I very rarely felt in this game like I was struggling to make something happen. I was struggling to make the optimal thing happen, but I could almost always make something happen. And that was really kind of rewarding in its own way.
Yeah, I agree with that. Now, there's another thing that I really dig about this game, and that is that, you know, there's some specific goals you're working towards in the game, right? The game starts with you having this boat that is a bunch of negative points. 5 negative points for every room that's not completely filled, 1 negative point for every rat that's visible on your boat. So you've got these goals that you're trying to fill up. You also, if you can cover over a treasure map on your boat with a specific color cat, that's great. You know that if you can connect a bunch of cats of the same color, you're going to get a lot of points for that. So you've got these goals. But the lesson cards is one of my favorite things about the game. Lesson cards are some of the cards you can draft, and there are private lessons and public lessons. But these lessons basically are goal cards, and they kind of motivate you to do specific things for extra points at the end of the game. And I love that, and I love the fact that they're not just there at the beginning of the game. The first round, you might not really know what you're trying to drive to, but the next round, you draft something. Ooh, now I've got to get 5 gold cats or 5 orange cats on my boat to make sure that I can meet this goal. So now I've got a little extra driver. In the next round, somebody plays a public lesson. Oh, there's another goal that's going to get me a little extra bonus. So you kind of all of a sudden have all these little, you know, mini games that you're trying to play, along with all the basic goals of covering up the rooms and covering up the rats. And that, to me, I've used this term before, a shifting tactical puzzle, that works here, right? Because it's constantly like the goalposts change about what you're trying to get done in this game. And it's just so much fun. And then you have to balance out the benefit of like covering over those negative points versus going for the extra 1, you know, 7 points for this 1 lesson card that you're going to get. That's a hard trade-off. And am I going to do the math in my head? Absolutely not. I'm going to play it by my gut, but it feels good to get that goal card done. I'll just see what I can do with, you know, with the boat aside from that. So I really enjoy the lesson cards part of this game.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I liked about them, and I thought this was kind of clever, they were so different. Because there's a lot of games where there's kind of broad goals, like the more you have of this, then you get that many points. This was a really interesting mix of extremely specific lesson cards. Like I had one that was, if you have exactly 5 green cats, then you got 10 points. Versus more open ones, like if you have the most cats in a particular family, which is another card that I had, then you got 7 or 8 points, all the way to these really open-ended ones, like you get 2 points for every, I forget the name of it, not the common, but the extreme treasures or super treasures. So for 2 points for every one of those, you can really choose to go for some very specific goals and get a lot of points, or try to maximize these general cards by doing a lot of the same thing over and over again. I thought that was interesting, both because they were fun goals and because they were different ways of approaching the game. And that was kind of neat.
Yeah, totally. 100% agree on that. In fact, I had one of the lesson cards was have exactly six lesson cards at the end of the game. So I was kind of motivated to pick up all these other lessons, which I was doing. But then I was starting to realize I couldn't fill all the lessons. So the last round, I had this tough decision of, do I draft these last 2 lessons that I can't actually hit at all, but it'll help me meet this one card? Or do I pick up some treasure cards that will help me with this other lesson that'll... So like I had to give that up. I didn't end up meeting the lesson, but it was really fun to pursue that and make choices around it. So interesting and fun choices every time.
So you had mentioned before, Tim, something about getting that 20 fish per round automatically. And you said you like that. Is that so? You found that to be more desirable than, say, a game where you have an engine where you're trying to build up your ability to generate income over time. What did you like about that?
Yeah, I think they're different. But, you know, again, it was just the fact that you don't feel so constricted. Like, you know, okay, well, here's a great example. I mean, terraforming Mars, I mentioned already, which can happen, especially you get into the second round. All you're stuck with is, 20 credits, and maybe you can pay for two cards and play one. And that just feels like such a short round. Here, all the rounds feel like you can do plenty because of that. Gaia Project's a great example of a game where the first round, you know, you have enough resources you start with, but then you have to start putting mines out and putting trading stations or whatever to build up some resources. So the second round of the game always feels so short, and it feels like you can do almost nothing because you haven't built up enough to get the resources you need to do anything. And so there is an arc, and that is a fun challenge. I'm not saying I don't like that, but I also like this, where this is that's one piece of the game you don't have to work for. You can put your focus on making the tough decisions about which cards do you draft, which cards do you keep after you draft them, which cats are you drafting, you know, where do you place the cats? And there's plenty of tough decisions here to make that you don't have to make me fight for that 20 fish. And the cool thing is about that economy is that you can still treat it as if I draft a bunch of cheap cards or I don't play out everything this round, I may have some fish left for next round. So I can build up for kind of a bigger round next time. So there's still an economy to play with. But I do appreciate sometimes when a game just gives you something. And there are a few games, I mentioned Legrand, how they did that. But sometimes when a game just gives me something, that makes me happy. Like, just let me have something.
Yeah.
And just have fun with it and not have to work for every single piece of it. So I think that's why, it's satisfactory to me here.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's almost like the designers are saying, we want you to focus on this, not on these five other things. And that's nice sometimes. I mean, certainly there are games where that's done to good effect, where you have, you know, many things you're focusing on. The Gaia Project is probably a good example, and I've come around to enjoying that game quite a bit. But it's amazingly frustrating doing those first couple of rounds where you're like, I will never have enough to do what I want to do here. There's no possible way to get it done. It's always frustrating. And that's part of the game. I mean, it's understandable, and that's part of the challenge of it. But in this one, you don't have that level of frustration. So maybe that makes it slightly lower weight, slightly less complicated, but it also makes it a little bit more rewarding in a way too.
Yeah. Now let me talk about the one thing that I've always found to be a little bit disappointing and challenging with this game. And that is that there's something about the rule set here. It's not a heavy game. It's not a particularly complicated game, but it's a very hard game to approach as a new player. There are some rules here that are just feel hard to grasp. So for example, and this has happened every single time I've taught this game, and it happened again tonight, I taught Chris and Steve the game. They both watched how to play videos on it, so they already came in knowing how to play it. But both of them, the first round and even going into the second round, Steve was so confused about the fact that you've taken these rescue cards, which are the green cards that will give you baskets or half baskets, and they'll give you boots, that you have to play a rescue card to rescue a cat. But that's not the case. The rescue cards don't have anything to do with how many cats you can rescue. They just tell you how many baskets you have, and that determines how many cats you can rescue. So that whole piece is just, for the weight of this game, it's a little bit challenging to kind of get across. Now, it's not complicated once you've played it. It's not like it doesn't take any brain power at all after a game or two of it. But I have found this game to be hard to teach new people. And that makes me less likely to bring it to the audience that I think this is a great fit for. This is kind of a gateway plus game. It's got a great approachable theme, something that's going to get people excited to play games. But holy cow, I would never teach this to somebody that didn't at least have some experience playing games because of some of the quirkiness of those rules that make it really, and drafting is another piece of the rule set. When you're trying to teach a new game to somebody, teaching a game that requires drafting is hard because people can't ask you questions. What does this do as they're, you know, passing around the table? You can't teach them as you're playing it. You know, you kind of have to show them all the different types of cards before you even start playing to explain what they do. So there's a couple elements here that make this game just a little bit less approachable than it probably should be for the audience that it has. it's not a barrier once you know the game, and it's not a barrier for gamers that are, you know, regular gamers and once they get the hang of it. But did you feel, Chris, that it was a little bit challenging to get into, probably more than you expected?
I didn't find it that challenging to get into, other than that one rule. And once you explained it to me and I understood it, it was no challenge at all. I felt like it clicked right into place. But I get your point. For people who don't play games regularly, that is not going to be in any way intuitive. And it would probably not be that easy to explain it to them and have them internalize it and be able to repeat it for the next, you know, several rounds. And I can imagine it being really irritating. So I really get your point. This does feel like a game that you'd love to be able to take this out and wow people with how much fun is that this is. You know, these cats that you place and these, you know, shapes.
And yeah. And there's one more thing. I'm going to leave this for the production conversation that also makes it just a little bit more heavy to deal with, more fiddly than it needs to be, or that a game of this kind of weight and target should be. But we'll talk about that in production a little bit. But I just want to mention, too, that even though you and Steve, like, you had a little bit of challenge with that rule, and Steve had several rules that he was mixing up into the second round. It was like, oh, I've totally messed up the game. But our end game, and I've played the game like a dozen times, and I thought I was going to crush you guys, we all ended up within like 5 points of each other. So you all were still able to play competitively. We had very different routes to our points. That was fun to see, like, where our points came from were completely different, and yet we all played pretty competitively with you guys coming in, you know, first time to it. So, you know, even though it was a little bit of a challenge to get everybody up and running and making sure they understood what was going on, everyone seemed to be able to play it competitively, and that's cool to see. So let's jump into the production and theme of this game. Now, this is where the game really shines, and that's the theme as well as the production. For me, this is a wonderful, wonderful theme. It's the idea that you're going to this island, you've got a boat, and you've got to rescue these cats off this kind of fantasy island. The cats are not like normal cats. They look a lot like cats. They act like cats, but they all are bright colors. They all have slight little different flares on them that a normal cat wouldn't have. So it's kind of a fantasy world, but you have to go and rescue these cats because there's this evil villain that's coming to this island, and any cats that are there, he's going to slaughter them all. Like, so it's this little bit of a dark fantasy theme that's going on. And then you put these cats on your boat. They fit perfectly in the polyominoes because cats just stretch in all kinds of different directions, right? They got their legs up in the air. They're sprawled all over the place. And so your polyominoes are all different shapes to match with the shapes that these cats fit in. What a pleasure to just pull these cats on, put them on your boat, see these cats lounging all over your boat in different shapes and, you know, sprawled all over the place. Holy cow. I love everything about the theme of this. And it's executed so well in the production. The artwork's beautiful. As I mentioned, I've got the physical production of this, so it's nice, thick, chunky tiles. It's the player boards are these big boat tiles that all have unique artwork depending on which player color you are. I just love the production. I have just a couple minor criticisms on it, but minus those, I just love everything that this thing's doing from a production perspective. So, Chris, what did you think? This was your first play of it.
I thought it was a ton of fun. I mean, in the end, it's going to be a lot of cardboard, so, you know, there's that. So this is a game that really is going to live and die by its art, and boy, is the art fun here, for all the reasons that you said. It was funny because half of the way through the game, I think Steve mentioned something about he had dragons flying over his boat. And this is not in any way related to the game itself. It's just the art around the board that's kind of fun and adds a little bit of color. And so then we looked at our boards and I had these sailfish and, you know, Tim had squids, I think, giant squids. And so, yeah. And so we were looking at that just kind of in wonder going, wow, how cool that is. This looks so neat. And the cats, I mean, you said it, but these cats look like anybody who's owned a cat has seen these poses before. I mean, there's the cat. It was in a cross-shaped tile where its legs are sticking up in the air in opposite directions and it's licking its crotch. I mean, that's kind of like every cat owner has seen that pose before. It's charming. It's fun. It's adorable. Yet still, it's fantastical. It's a lot. So that makes it kind of exciting and interesting for anybody who likes something that's not photorealistic. And I just thought that was great. I really enjoyed that about it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, so let me just talk about, and also, you know, like, it's cardboard and then it's drafting you know, drafting cards. The cards are nice quality. The physical production of the cards, they're all pretty clearly spelled out what they do. They've got nice artwork. They've got artwork of these cats on them. So they're beautiful looking cards and everything. So all that stuff is great. The fish components, so the resources, the money that you're spending are these fish tokens, right? And so in the main game, you can either get their one fish chits, which just have a little fish on it, it's a little blue fish, or their five fish chits, but it looks like three fish next to each other. And then in the background, there's like two shadows of fish behind it. So I had to mention that because Jen would kill me if I didn't, because her and my wife have complained about that every single time we played it, because the five fish chits look like three fish. So I bought this. There was a Kickstarter upgrade kit that you could buy that upgrades. It gives you a couple bonus tiles, extra cats to put in your draw bag and stuff. But it also gives you wooden fish to replace the cardboard fish. And they have the exact same art on it. So the five fish chits still look like three fish chits. So I had to mention that. It's not a big deal. Once you know it, it's no big deal at all to me. But everybody loves to complain about that. So I had to bring it up.
With the player boards, are the player boards double layered or are they single layered?
No, they're single layered. They're nice thick cardboard, but they're just single layered player boards. All of the cardboard components here, including the tiles, are hefty. They feel nice to handle, even though they're just cardboard. Like I said, I probably played my version of it 10 to 12 times and nothing feels like it's wearing or anything like that. So it's high quality cardboard, but it's just cardboard. You know, I mean, if you got a big polyomino space like that, what good does a dual layer board do? Like just the edges, you know, might be raised, but it really wouldn't impact your experience very much. But you do have the risk, of course, of like having all these tiles and then somebody bumps your player board and things get shuffled around a little bit. And it's happened a couple times, but they're not dual layered.
It would impact my experience. I would love to have a dual layered player board there. Maybe I'm crazy, but I would.
All right. Sorry, you don't get it. I don't know whether to mention this in components, you know, production, or whether I should have mentioned this in the gameplay, but there's something about the drafting of this that is very challenging to keep track of. The reason I think is because you have these private lessons, which you keep face down. You don't put them face up, right? Because you don't want anyone else to know what your private lessons are. So you've got these private lesson cards. You've got a handful of cards that you may have leftover cards from the previous round. And then you're drafting cards. And so as you're drafting, you're taking cards and then you're passing a pile and you've got new cards. Physically playing this game, we've constantly had a challenge of like, wait, what is this pile? Oh, these are my face down cards. Oh, wait, are these my lesson cards? Oh, no, I just drafted these. And something about that feels just a little bit unwieldy, which I haven't felt in other drafting games. And I think it mostly has to do with the fact that you've got the face down lessons cards as well, which just adds one more pile that you have to deal with. I mean, even in a regular draft, I've definitely had challenges with people like, wait, there's three cards here and two cards here. Which pile is this? You know, like people get ahead of their drafts and stuff. But something about it is just a little bit unwieldy here. So minor complaint here. Again, it's I guess that's a gameplay thing, but it always feels like the components themselves are just kind of getting in the way of themselves. So one more thing I'd say that's a little bit of a barrier to entry for new players and makes it a little weird to handle and to play with. Otherwise, I love the production, I love the artwork, and I really, really love the theme here. There are not many games that I would pick over this from a theme perspective, because it's unique, it's pleasant, I want to be in that world, but there's a sense of urgency because there's some risk if you don't, you know, if you don't help these cats. So I love everything that's doing. Any other thoughts on the theme and production, Chris?
I've got to address the elephant in the room. Why in the world has this guy mobilized an army to kill cats? I love a good story, and this strains credibility, to say the least.
Chris, I don't think you've ever watched an anime, because there's always a bad guy doing something ridiculously stupid for no good motivation other than to motivate the heroes to get into action. I think it's a very traditional fantasy storyline here. I don't know. Maybe you should check into the backstory. Maybe Frank West, the designer of Isle of Cats, will jump onto Twitter and let us know why he thinks Evil Lord Vishna, or whatever his name is.
This evil lord, we'll just call him the evil lord. So, you know, but I want to know. I mean, inquiring minds want to know, what does he have against cats? You know, all these resources that he has, is that all he has? Is like that he uses his entire army to take out these cats, or is he doing other things with his army as well? It's like, I want to know the story behind this.
Let me just tell you, Chris, that the entire world consists of people out there hunting animals and wiping them off the face of the planet to consume them, or for their furs, or the medicinal properties of it. this is no different. This fantasy world, this guy, maybe he's like just the 101 Dalmatians woman of the cat world, right? He's just like, I want to skin all these cats. So I don't know. It's like it exists. This is the world we live in.
Fair enough. But I will say nobody eats cats. Nobody eats cats. I don't think anybody eats cats. So enough said on that.
All right. Well, let's move into the final question of, would you request to play the game again? Chris, what do you think?
Man, I sure would. This is a lot of fun. I enjoyed this game. I like the fact that you got to get to the fun part, which is placing your polyominoes, picking them and placing them without a whole lot of overhead. You just got to go do it. Unlike Feast for Odin, which is also a good game, but has way too much thought going on in that game. You know, there's too much thinking to do and not enough fun stuff to do. Or you got to do too much thinking to get to the fun stuff. Here you just get to the fun stuff. And I like that. You add to it the charming theme and the fun art and the bizarre story and the fact that you can say the name to this game to the tune of Baby Shark. And it is just all fun all the time.
Nice. Do you see this being something that you would like kind of throw into the rotation and you're starting up a board game arena game and just invite a few people to it?
Absolutely. I was thinking about starting up a game with, you know, me, you, Adam, whatever, right after the podcast. And I want to play it again. I mean, I played it and immediately want to jump right back into another game. If we'd had time to do it, I would have liked to have played another game tonight. It was that much fun. Well, what about you? You have this game, and I feel like this is one that you've been pretty excited about.
Yeah, so this was actually a tough choice for me. I want to say that this is a game that has been on my shelf for about a year, and I brought it to the table. I introduced it to my wife and Jen. They both enjoyed it, and Jen was asking to play it several times, so she really got into it right away. A few months back, I was about to sell a bunch of games, and my wife was like, "Why didn't you sell Isle of Cats?" And I was like, "Well, I thought you liked that game." She's like, I don't know. It's not something I think about that much. So it obviously wasn't a huge hit for her, but she doesn't mind playing it. Jen likes playing it. But personally, I haven't really requested. Like, you know, I've got 30, 40 games in my collection, and I haven't been asking to bring it back. So I thought to myself, how am I going to answer this question tonight? But the reality is that I think I am going to keep it in my collection, and I think I am going to ask to play it again once in a while. I always have a fun time playing it. We're playing it tonight. It's like, I love this game. It's got so many cool little things going on for the wait. You know, it's terraforming Mars at half the length of time, maybe more than that. It's got a more charming theme in production than almost anything in my collection. So for that reason alone, that big white box, it's the box of it is beautiful if you haven't seen it, but it's a big white box with just the words Isle of Cats on the front with a bunch of cats lounging around on it. And I just love the box just being on my shelf. The production's great. It's fun to play with the cards. It's fun to do all this stuff. So it's not a game that's driving me crazy to just get back to it all the time, but I always have fun playing it. And I think there are regularly going to be times where I'm like, man, we haven't played Isle of Cats for a while. I want to get that one out. So this is going to be one of those rare ones on my shelf that I feel like it's not something that I, you know, constantly go back to, but I still love it enough to not want to get rid of it. And I want to go back to it every once in a while, at least. So it's kind of on the fringe for me, but had a great time with it again tonight. Wanted to play another game like you did. I'd be happy to play it anytime somebody invites me on Board Game Arena. So I think this is a game that will continue to, you know, to get played over the years and continue to, you know, bring joy as I introduce it to new people over time.
Yeah. And I think Board Game Arena is actually a factor here because there's a lot of games where I've learned to love them through Board Game Arena because it's so easy to get a game in. It's so easy to throw it down on the table. And that makes me want to own it. So I could definitely see playing a few games of this, and if I still felt as enthusiastic about it, wanting to own a copy of it, even if I was primarily playing it online. So I think that's a factor here as well.
And by the way, I did play the solo game of this, and it's actually really fun and really great as well. Plays really well, but it hasn't been a game that's been driving me to go back solo either. So again, you know, same situation. If you love the game and you don't have someone else to play it with, there's a good solo game in here. To me, it's one of those games that's always fun when I play it. Doesn't get me super excited, but, you know, for all the reasons I mentioned tonight, I like to go back to it, and I think I'll be keeping around. All right, cool. Well, I think that'll wrap up our conversation on the Isle of Cats. Chris has an Isle of Cats themed cocktail for us tonight, and then we'll talk about a couple games we've been playing and some future takes right after this. All right, welcome back. So, Chris, what do you have for us this week?
So, we're talking cocktails, and cats don't generally drink cocktails. I think we can all agree on that. So, this created a little bit of a dilemma for me when I was picking the drink for tonight's game. So I considered a fallback, you know, something that had, you know, cat in its name, like Cat's Meow or the Tomcat or something like that, which I honestly did not look up, but I guarantee there must be drinks out there with those names. Truth is, that just seemed a little bit lazy to me. So that brought me back to my original question was, if a cat did drink a cocktail, you know, what would it choose to drink? And the answer, my friends, I will pose in the form of a myth. And then I'm going to debunk that myth. So here we go. In every story that we've ever read, in every cartoon that we've ever watched, the mouse always wants to eat what?
The cheese.
Of course. And the cat wants to drink what?
The milk.
Right. But the truth is, cats don't actually have the intestinal enzymes necessary to digest milk, making them basically lactose intolerant. So while a cat may drink milk, it's definitely not the staple that popular culture would have you believe it is. Bam, myth busted. But these are mythical cats. So we're going to say, just for the sake of fun, that these cats do actually drink milk. That, in fact, they love milk to go with their fish, of course. So that brings us to tonight's drink, which is the bourbon milk punch. Now, I know this sounds really bizarre. And that's what I thought when I found this recipe too. But it's actually a venerable recipe that has its roots going all the way back to the 1600s. And from what I've read, it's actually still a popular brunch drink in New Orleans, which reminds me that I need to, next time I go to New Orleans, see if I can find myself a good milk punch. But either way, it's crazy delicious, even if it does sound a little bit wacky. So here's what you're gonna need. And it's surprisingly simple, and it is actually one of the easiest drinks in terms of getting the right ingredients, probably stuff you already have around the house. You're gonna need 3 ounces of whole milk, ideally whole milk. I haven't tried it with another kind of milk, but I think whole milk is probably the way to go. 2 ounces of bourbon, or pretty much any American whiskey will do. You could even use brandy, which is another variation on this drink if you're not a whiskey fan. 1 ounce of simple syrup and 2 dashes of vanilla extract. You're gonna mix all these ingredients in a shaker with ice, lots of ice, give the whole thing a good shake, and strain it into a rocks glass. A couple of these and you will be ready to curl up in the sun on a quilt and take a nap, at least after your game is done.
Chris, you sent me the recipe for this drink tonight and it did not disappoint. It was delicious. The little bit of, what's the powder that's on top of it?
The nutmeg.
The nutmeg that you put on top of it reminded me a little bit of the holiday. So it did feel a little seasonal. Absolutely delicious drink. And now, as a 45-year-old human being, I can't drink these too often because whole milk or half and half or whatever cream mixture you're mixing with these drinks, I'm in an age where my metabolism doesn't handle that stuff very well. But very pleasurable game night because of this delicious drink. I loved it. You should absolutely try it. And I will be bringing this back as a regular for my holiday drink mix schedule.
Nice. And thank you for reminding me about the nutmeg. I actually forgot to mention that because I actually hadn't done that when I made the drink. I made it without, but you're right. That is actually part of the recipe. So thank you. So grate a little bit of nutmeg on top and you'll enhance your holiday drink a little bit more even.
All right. Very nice. Well, thanks for the theme cocktail tonight, Chris. Let's talk about some games that have been on our table. So Chris, you told me you didn't have any games to talk about, but I want to talk a little bit more about a game you mentioned a couple times tonight, and that is A Feast for Odin. This is a game that I've been playing for a couple of years, have had a decent amount of fun with, and I have some mixed feelings on. But you, out of the blue, invited me to a game of A Feast for Odin on Board Game Arena. And this is a game that I never, ever thought I'd play with you. I really didn't think you'd ever be interested in playing it. So I want to hear your initial thoughts. Kind of, we played 2 games together. I don't know if you've played any others, but tell me a little bit about A Feast for Odin and how that's gone for you.
I alluded to some of this before in our discussion of Isle of Cats. And for those who are not familiar with the game, it is essentially a two-part game. On the one hand, you have polyominoes, where you're trying to fill in a village board, I think it's called. And The other part of the game is this immense worker placement grid where I don't know what it is. I haven't counted them up, but it feels like there's about 40 different worker placement spaces, each of which does something different, each of which costs a certain number of workers. And you have to place your workers in the right place to get the right polyomino to fit in the right exact spot. And there's about three or four different boards, each of which requires polyominoes of different sizes. So you have multiple places you can put them. You have islands you can investigate. You have your feast table. You have your main village board. And so the two parts of this are this really huge worker placement area that get you the pieces that you're trying to place on your board, and then the board where you actually place them. And this feels almost like two separate games. I mean, obviously they're tied together because you're going to try to take moves that get you the pieces of the right size and of the right shape. It is quite fun. And the reason that I'd never played it before was the way you, basically you had turned me off of it by the way you described it, which was this huge, ugly box of cardboard chits that was like, it had a million little pieces to set out. And I thought, wow, I can't think of anything in the game world that's less attractive than that. But once again, thank goodness for BGA, where they do all the work for you and you can just jump in and start playing the game. And it's actually not a bad game. I enjoy the pieces of it. But the truth is, I feel like the worker placement aspect of it is just a little bit too complicated. I feel like I want to start placing tiles in my board, and the amount of thought that has to go into planning out what is the optimal move that I can take that's going to get me the right piece, that's going to do the right this and the right that, it feels like I have to put way too much thought into each turn in order to make it work. And that doesn't mean I never want to play it, because I do want to play it. But I feel like I have to be in the right state of mind for it, and I have to be willing to really dedicate some time to be able to optimize my turns. And I've only played it a couple times, so maybe that would come over time and I'd get much better at it. So it is sort of a mixed bag. Now, you said you have mixed feelings about this as well, so I'm curious to hear, because I thought you were just a 100% straight-up fan of this game.
No, I'm not. I like the game a lot. I think it does some really interesting things, and I think the problem for me, or the concern for me, I guess, is that there is really no variability in it. You know, as far as the worker placement spaces are always the same, your player board's always the same, so the options you can take are always the same. So it kind of feels like you could identify a path that's going to be the best and just go down that path and keep doing the same things. And that's redundant and that's not fun. You've got all this huge variety of options. So make me do some different options. And the game does. It gives you one mechanism that makes you do different options, and that is the occupation cards. And that's what has made the game fun for me every time. Basically, at the beginning of the game, you start with one occupation card, and these are little cards that will give you, when you play them, they will give you some minor benefit either immediately when you play it, or whenever you do a certain thing, you'll get another benefit. And so it kind of drives you to go down certain paths. And I think if you don't optimize on those occupation cards, you know, you're going to be less successful. So that's kind of what gives you the variability in the game. And I'm just not sure if it's enough. I still enjoy every play of it. I still look forward to playing it once in a while. But there's not as much exploration, I guess, in the game. For what a massive game it is, the game is a little lacking in exploration of new paths to me. I guess that's my only concern about it, or complaint about it. Like, I've got the game sitting on my shelf here, and I've thought several times, like, do I need to keep this game around? It's a little heavier than I want to play solo. It's a good solo game because of you do all the same things. You don't have to wait for somebody else. And it kind of does a good job of blocking you from taking the same actions over and over again, because basically the solo game, whatever workers you played in the previous round, you leave those there, and then you play with a new set of workers from a different color the next round. So you cannot take the same actions two rounds in a row. So it kind of gets you in your own way, but you can plan around it a little bit. So it's a good solo game. It's a good implementation, and it's just a beat your own score solo game, but in a good way. But it's a little heavier than I want to play solo. Like, typically, if I'm going to sit down and play a solo game, I want it to be a little lighter, get it done in 30, 45 minutes. And this is a good hour and a half, you know, hour and a half getting through this and making all these tough decisions. From a solo game, it's a little too heavy. From a multiplayer game, it's a little bit too multiplayer solitaire. There's very little interaction with the other players. I do understand that the expansion to it gives you, I think, a tighter two-player board. Like, it replaces the worker placement board. So when you're playing two players, it's a little smaller. So that might be worth trying. And I've said that before. I'll probably purchase the Norwegians expansion if I was going to, you know, recommend to play this with somebody else in person again. That could be fun. I've had a good time every time I played it, but I just don't know if I've had enough fun for all the, you know, brain power and everything that's going into it. So it's a game that's like, it's sitting on my shelf and it feels like such a classic and it feels like it's got so many cool things going on. And I'll probably keep it because it's a game that every once in a while, it's a big, cool, epic experience. And because I don't play it that often, it still feels like I'm exploring it. But I don't think it's a game that I'll keep going back to and playing all the time. So that's kind of how I feel about it. I don't love it, but I like it a lot. And I'm always happy to play it. It's just, it fits in an interesting space for me.
So I'm fixating on something that you said a minute ago. And you talked about Feast for Odin, the Norwegians expansion. Wouldn't that be sort of like Isle of Cats, the Cats expansion?
The Feline expansion. Yeah, totally.
Right. Isn't that exactly like the Norwegians kind of were the Vikings? I mean, maybe, you know, apologies to any Norwegian listeners we may have who are like, you're a moron and you don't know any history. On a more serious note, I get what you're saying about the difficulty of getting this one out and making it fit in the right space. And as you were saying that, I was thinking to myself, I don't think I would ever want to play this outside of BGA. Now, I'm going to contradict myself because just a few minutes ago, when we were talking about Isle of Cats, I was talking about the fact that once I start playing a game in Board Game Arena and start enjoying it, I want to buy a copy of it. This is actually an outlier in the sense that I don't think I ever would. I don't think I want to play this one in hard copy. I think I like the simplicity of playing it in BGA, and I don't think I'd want to mess with that. So I'm not sure what that says.
Fair enough. And I think, though, that this is a couple things about the physical production. One is that they give you these really nice trays that all of the, and they're covered trays. So all of the different tiles, all the different rectangle tiles you're playing with, you don't have to like separate those all out. So setting up is actually much easier than it seems like it's going to be. And there is a fun tactileness of like you're collecting all these little pieces and then while someone else is taking their turn before the round ends, you can start to put them all onto your board. So I think you might find that it's actually pretty enjoyable to play in person and it doesn't really overcomplicate things. I feel like the experience is pretty close in person versus Board Game Arena. So I can understand that feeling, but if you try it one time, you might feel differently. Yeah. All right, cool. Well, I'm glad to hear that you liked it, Chris. That's cool to hear and love to play with you anytime you feel up for it. I want to talk about a game that I have had a chance to play recently, and that is Rolling Realms. Rolling Realms was designed by Jamie Stegmeyer and published by Stonemeyer Games. If you haven't heard the story of this game, it's kind of a cool story. Back in like April of 2020, right after everything was shut down for the pandemic, everyone was told to stay home, be in your houses, etc. And Jamie Stegmeyer kind of put together a little thing. He said, hey, people don't have anything to do, so I'm going to make a little roll and write that's made so that you could play it on Zoom. You could play with anybody. And so he kind of created this like out of the blue. I mean, I remember just kind of watching it happen on social media where one day he's like, hey, if anyone wants to join me in for a live Zoom of this little game I created, I think he was calling it Seven Realms at the time. I'll, you know, basically just put up a sheet on my website. You can download it, print it, and we'll play it together. And he went through several iterations and people were enjoying getting on there. Basically the game, well, I'll explain how the game works and I'll explain how this works. But basically there's two six-sided dice and you have a set of, in every round, you have a set of three different little mini games that you can play. They all have little spaces on them that you can mark off numbers from the dice. So you'd roll these two dice and you have to use one dice on one of the realms, one of the cards, and one dice on one of the other cards. And so you can do this with any number of people, and you can do this on Zoom, because if you have your own sheet in front of you, all you're really doing is recording the numbers on your own sheet. And each of the sheets plays differently. One of the clever things about this is that he named each of these little mini games after one of his own games and put elements into it. So each of the realms, the Rolling Realms, represent one of the Stonemeyer game productions. So for example, the Tapestry minigame is a little grid that looks like a capital city mat in Tapestry. And depending on the number that you pick, Each of those numbers corresponds to a shape, kind of like a little polyomino shape. And so whenever you pick the number, let's say you pick the one, it's a 1x1 square. So you can just draw a little 1x1 square on your little grid. The map has some spaces blocked out already. But if you pick the six, it might be a 4x2 grid with like a little shape, like an L shape to it or something like that. So you plug it into the space and basically you're going to get a star if you complete a row or complete a column in this grid. And the goal, the points in the game are stars. So each mini game has a max of 6 stars you can get. But as you complete little sections of this grid, you can also get resources. And there are 3 resources in the game: pumpkins, gold coins, and there's one other, hearts, I think. So you can get these resources and you track them on this other little sheet of paper where you just circle the resources you've collected. But then you can spend the resources to do some things. Like you can spend, I can't remember offhand, but like you could spend X number of coins to get a dice of X pips, like, so basically a bonus action. Or you can spend 2 hearts to duplicate a dice when you've got doubles or something like that. So you can kind of spend these resources to do bonus actions and adjust your dice and things like that. Also, at the end of the round, aside from the stars being points, any resources you have left over are a tenth of a point. So if you have 3 resources left over, you might have like 14.3 points. So it kind of counts as a tiebreaker in the rounds. So that's how the game plays. So obviously you could play this on Zoom with any number of people. Each of you has the 3 little realms for that round. You roll the 2 dice, you draw 1 number on one, you draw 1 number on the other. And each of the mini games, I mentioned the tapestry room, but each of the mini games are very different and they correspond to a game in the Stonemaier Games world. All kind of fun, clever little situations going on. So he created this during the pandemic, went through a couple iterations on it, and there was a lot of demand to say like, hey, can you print up a professional version of this? So just in late 2021, I think, he actually published the game. I picked this game up brand new on Game Nerds. I think it was like $13.50 or something like that. I think the MSRP is like $20. But the way the game comes in the production, you get 6 decent quality white board markers, 6 different colors of player decks. And each of the decks has like 12, maybe it's 11 different realms in it. And they're all little whiteboard cards. So basically, one person will take out 3 cards. Everyone else gets the same 3 cards in a round. And then after you score up that round, you put those aside and you pull out 3 more cards. So every game, you're going to see 9 realms in it, 9 cards. And there are these little whiteboard cards. It also comes with little whiteboard erasers, so you can clean off the cards after you use them. You also have every player also has a little whiteboard card for marking your score and for marking your resources. So cute little component set here. It's pretty light. Rule books are pretty standard. There's a cool solo mode in this game as well, and it's a map, a mini golf map. And then each hole in the mini golf map has a specific challenge. So like hole 1 might say, pull out realm this X, X, and X, and then you have this specific extra challenge to do with it. And then you're trying to score up over this 18-hole mini golf realm. I haven't played it yet, but it looks fun. It looks pretty clever. It's a nice little added production there for the solo game. So I did pick this up recently. I had a chance to play it. My family was in town last weekend, and I think we played probably 4 or 5 games of it. It's very cute. It's very clever. It's got a lot of variety in it because every time you play, you're playing with 3 different realms and they kind of combo in different ways. Like one, you roll a dice, you do this thing, but then it gives you a bonus resource, which you can then use on this other realm to do something else. All really fun, good variety. Had a really good time with it. So I like the game a lot. One of the things they're starting to do is then with every new game they publish, they've done it now, a Rolling Realms promo and a Libertalia promo, where now you can, on their website, buy another little pack of cards where you get the extra card for every color, you know, every player color. And I did that. Like, I just ordered Libertalia, so I went ahead and ordered those couple promos. They also worked with another publisher and did a Terra Mystica promo card for it. And I get the impression that they're probably going to do that with other publishers as well. So it just adds more variety every time you play, you're playing with different cards. What did I think about the game? I had a lot of fun with it. It's fairly dry, you know, like you're basically just taking numbers off a 6-sided die and writing them onto a little card. So little mini games are fun, but there's not a lot of big combo-y stuff that's going on. You don't mark something and then that cascades into a bonus that marks something else or anything like that. It's 2 fairly simple actions every time. But we had fun with it. I played with my family a lot. They wanted to keep going back to it and playing it. The game is fairly simple, but each of the cards, because they play a little bit different, it's a little bit of, you know, you got to explain it, especially to newer players. oh yeah, this works like this. Okay, wait, I got to watch you and correct what you're doing. There was definitely a few mistakes the first couple times we were playing it. But I think for the price of the game, it is an absolute value. I did buy the promo cards because I want to keep playing it. I think it's a great filler. You can knock it out in 20, 30 minutes for a full 3-round game of it. And just have some fun variety and some, you know, fun little challenges. Because it's a roll and write, there's no interaction at all with the other players, right? It's, you're just playing against the dice. It's a fun filler game. I enjoyed it and look forward to playing some more with it and trying out some of these other realms that come out with it.
So Tim, compare this one to, say, Welcome To, which is a game that we've played a lot of and we did a review on. In terms of both the weight and the fun, how would you compare the two of them?
Weight-wise, it's probably just slightly heavier than Welcome To, just because you have to teach all the different mini games and kind of grasp them. And some of them are just slightly tricky as far as, like, how do they work. So maybe just a little bit heavier than Welcome To. I definitely think I could teach Welcome To easier. On the other hand, when you're teaching this game, you're only teaching 3 of the mini games versus you're having to teach what, you know, 6 of the different card bonuses do in Welcome To. So that's probably approximate, but over the course of the game, you've got to teach 9 of these different mini games. So it's a little bit heavier entry. Thematically, I think it fails a little bit compared to Welcome To, because Welcome To just, you know, like, it's got this beautiful artwork that represents this 1950s style little community, and everything that you're doing in the community matches up. Now, there's some coolness, especially if you have played or are a fan of Stonemaier's other games. You do get the kind of experience, the cleverness of saying, oh, I know why that, like, why Wingspan works like that, or why Viticulture works like that. And it's clever. And each of these mini games really does tie into the theme of the original game, and in some cases, the mechanisms to some extent. So that's cool. But thematically, the cards themselves are very abstract. You know, they're just basically white cards with, you know, spaces that you're filling in to represent the numbers that are on there. But there's no artwork on them. There's no pictures. So I think it kind of misses, you know, it doesn't quite hit the same notes that Welcome To does from that perspective. And from a general fun perspective, I think Welcome To is a little bit stronger for me as well. It's a different game. I like the variation. Like, I don't want to play 15 games of Welcome To in a row. I'd rather play a couple games of Welcome To and then play a couple games of Rolling Realms where I get some variety in the cards. But if I was going to pick one or the other, I would pick Welcome To as a great entryway roll and write fun filler experience. But I think Rolling Realms is doing some pretty clever things. It's a little thinkier. And it's got some fun tie into the Stonemaier game. So if you like their games, I think, you know, you'd have a good time playing around with it.
Have you actually played this remotely with anybody?
No, I haven't. And, you know, we actually talked about doing it because you can play it remotely. I thought this would be a fun game for us to do with our podcast crew, just as like a Zoom thing. So instead of playing on a digital implementation, let me just get these big dice out. I'll send everybody a scan of the cards and we can print that out and play it. The only reason I decided not to do that is because I don't think the game's heavy enough to warrant the full game conversation. We didn't do that and I haven't had a need to, but I think it would work just fine like that. All right, cool. So that will wrap up what we've had on our table this week. I do have one future take I want to mention. It was just announced this week and just a few spoilers. I haven't dug too far into it yet. I just last week talked about Now or Never by Red Raven Games and Ryan Lockett. And I always enjoy the story elements that they add into their Euro style, resource management style games. But one of the games that they published a couple years ago and I haven't had a chance to play yet is a game called Sleeping Gods, which is a big, epic storybook, you know, exploration adventure game. Very tempted to play it. This is only a solo or co-op game. Although I'm interested in it from a solo perspective, I don't have any interest in playing a co-op. And I'm just a little worried that it's going to be just too much kind of choose your own adventure and less about gameplay mechanism, just from what I've read and I've heard about it. I still would like to try it, but I definitely have been a little bit hesitant about it. But they just announced a standalone sequel to Sleeping Gods, and it's called Sleeping Gods Distant Skies. Not too much known about it right now, but instead of being on a steamer that just gets lost in a mist and ends up in this fantasy world, you're flying an airplane. Your cargo plane flies through a portal in the sky, transporting you to a landscape with bizarre creatures, scheming gods, untold dangers, blah, blah, blah. That was kind of taken from the BGG explanation. Kind of the similar idea. You now are flying this cargo plane and you're going to have to explore this new world. Sounds like they've taken some of the similar types of elements with it, but have maybe streamlined it a little bit from what I'm reading. they changed the combat mechanism, which sounded pretty interesting, about where you're laying out these monster cards. And as you do a combat, you cover over sections of monster card and then they attack you back. And it sounds like to me like kind of a deck building element where you're constructing a deck, and each combat you only draw a random hand of cards based on the deck you've constructed. And that sounds really fun to me, like almost a legacy style deck building thing where your deck grows over the course of the adventure. So that sounds fun, but also sounds like it might be more streamlined and quicker from a combat mechanism. But I think some of the adventuring and just other mechanisms of it sound like they might be a little more streamlined as well. So this has definitely caught my attention. It sounds like it might fix some of the concerns that I would have with playing a game like Sleeping Gods. Not to say that there are problems with the game, but just maybe not the game for me. This sounds like it might bring it a little bit closer to what would be really a good fit for me and still take advantage of the great story elements that Red Raven and Ryan Lockett tend to put in their game. So this has me pretty excited. I'm going to be keeping an eye on it. Definitely be watching for some game playthroughs and in a little bit more details about how the mechanisms work. But maybe this will be the game that I pick up instead of going with the original Sleeping Gods. Or maybe I'll still pick up Sleeping Gods, try it out, and then try this one eventually and see which is the better fit for me. But I'm really excited about this. Have you seen anything about this one, Chris?
Not this one. I've been intrigued by Sleeping Gods just because it seems like a really interesting kind of story, kind of game. And I feel like it falls into sort of my wheelhouse of things that I would enjoy. But I have not heard about this one. Do we know a release date for it?
I don't have any information about it yet. Let's see. They have a 2023 release date listed on BoardGameGeek. So sometime next year. Yeah, Red Raven is typically Kickstarter games, although they didn't do that with Near or Far, or with Now or Never, which is the game I just talked about last week. They actually did a pre-order system. And I don't know what their plans are with Sleeping Gods Distant Skies, but they've got a big enough name. I guess maybe it depends on how well Now or Never did for them versus Kickstarter campaigns as to whether they'll go back to it. But I'm guessing there'll be some kind of either a crowdfunding or a pre-order system for that. Maybe it'll be later this year. So I don't have more details than that right now, whether anything else has been released, but it's something I'll be keeping an eye on.
Definitely interested.
All right, cool. Well, I think that will wrap up this episode of Board Game Hot Takes. Somehow, Chris and I, by ourselves, still managed to talk for an hour and 15 minutes. So if you enjoy listening to the show and want to interact with us, we generally hang out on Twitter. You can find us at @BG_hottakes, and we'd love to chat with you, comment on our posts, and we'll respond back. Yeah, we love hanging out and chatting with our listeners, obviously. If you hear our polls that we do at the beginning of every episode, if you comment on those polls, sometimes we'll read your answers, but we love to have you partaking in that as well. Also, we've been playing a lot of Board Game Arena. If you play Board Game Arena or you're interested in trying it, find us. You can find the group Board Game Hot Takes on Board Game Arena. And if you join that group, you know, a lot of the time people are just, some of our listeners or even us are just reaching out and asking if anyone wants to jump in and play a game. And so we're starting up a lot of games and playing with listeners there, you know, join in and then friend us individually and invite us to games. And most of us are game to try new ones or play games that we know already. And we'd really appreciate it if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, you know, leave some nice comments there. We'll help other people find the show. And also reminds us that people are listening and appreciate what we're doing. So, you know, maybe we'll keep doing it.
And on BGA, I almost always lose. So if you need a little ego boost, invite me to a game.
Chris crushed me at Tapestry today. He had a big, big win against me today. All right, cool. Well, anyway, thanks for listening. Appreciate you all. Until next week, take care, everybody.
Good night, all.